Now for the extended version of our program where we have political potpourri. Who's on deck, Dima?
Well, the Daily Telegraph made basically a false story. I mean, if it's not even fake journalism, it's simply false. You know, they reported that Russia wants to block Odessa, and that the Royal Navy and other military
units are patrolling it. What is the significance of Odessa? What is the significance?
Odessa is a Russian-speaking city in the south of Ukraine, which is located on the Black Sea. Historically, the most important and the most bustling a port of the Russian Empire on the Black Sea, and it's on the territory controlled now by the Ukrainian regime. But of course, Russia is not going to blockade it, and of course, there was no, there were no facts that would indicate things moving in that direction. But we have the British Defense Minister Gavin Williamson coming to Ukraine, going to the border of the area held by the rebels, as usual, as always, on the side of the Ukrainian government, and making all kinds of belligerent statements about the need to.
Well, he's good at that. That's what he seems to excel in this.
Yeah. German Chancellor Merkel came here just recently, and after that, these people expect us to believe that Europe is neutral in this conflict, that Europe can be a mediator, that some kind of peacekeepers from Europe can make this area secure. Unfortunately, no, Europe is 100% on the side of Poroshenko and his regime.
They abrogated that position when they didn't condemn the coup regime when it happened.
Okay?
Repeatedly on this program, Yanukovych was everybody's friend.
Yes.
Until he wasn't their friend here. Mark, Fort Trump.
Yeah, okay. So Trump has decided he may pick up a Polish begging. The Poland has been begging the U.S. to put a permanent military
which would be a violation between the agreement made by NATO and Russia after the collapse of the
agreement. Multiple agreements,
yes,
actually.
1997, that agreement on the Founding Act.
And so it would actually be a conventional armed forces in Europe and other treaties as well. And the Poles are so desperate to be militarily occupied by the United States that they are willing to pay the United States to build a base and station troops there. So Trump has suddenly taken up favor of this idea, something he has actually before spoken against at the expense of U.S. troops in Poland, specifically because Poland has evidently suggested naming the base to be built on Russia's border Fort Trump. And this is all a little bit amazing. Poland is literally begging for this base, but the Polish media and elite suddenly reacted with anger and said they were humiliated because a picture of Trump and the Polish president signing a document together has Trump sitting down and the Polish president standing up. So it's okay to beg the United States, offer to pay for U.S. troops on their territory, but you feel humiliated by a picture?
You know, Glenn, one of the things I think, you know, I like to, on this program, think counterintuitively. Let's say, for example, a big American base is built in Poland. As part of NATO's infrastructure. Hypothetical. If there were some kind of conflict, wouldn't that base be the front line that would be obliterated? I mean, you're actually inviting a situation where you have less security and not more. Go ahead.
No, of course, I think this is the discussion we should have had with NATO expansion,
exactly.
A lot of this country should have had, because you had the same question with the Baltic states. Again, it was the Russians who pulled out dissolved the Soviet Union themselves. So the idea that the only reason why the Russians would eventually come after Poland or the Baltic states would be because of this huge American military presence. So obviously they're painting a big bullseye on themselves, and that's too bad. But but I wanted to add on what Dima said, because I think we often talked about how the United States, often its domestic politics tend to dictate its foreign policy, which is often how you define an irrational state. And I think we can expect to see more from Britain on this as well, because, again, if you see what's happening in British politics now, the Brexit discussions are going terribly. And as we discussed before, the British are in a huge need now to demonstrate their value to the rest of the continent. So essentially, they are the security provider.
Falkland Islands all over again?
Yeah, but I mean, but I think here is I think what the UK elites are doing is that as we go through this into the wilderness with Brexit, they're trying to prove to Washington, not their NATO allies, they're trying to prove to Washington their value. Yeah. So the UK will be their go-to country when it comes to NATO. We have polling results that the majority of Germans would like to see American troops leave Germany.
I think it's more than that. I think the UK is attempting to wag the US dog.
Okay, this said differently.
But it's obviously coordinated, because this comes, Dima didn't mention, the U.S. is stationing Royal Marine Commandos in Ukraine, right? They're also announced they're going to increase British, Royal Navy patrols of the Black Sea, which is quite a distance from the United Kingdom. And this is all happening at the same time and the same general location that the U.S. military in Ukraine is now building up a Ukrainian naval base, an old Ukrainian naval base, as a maritime operations support center.
What does that really mean, maritime support center? It's a base.
The U.S. is building a naval base in Ukraine, and British troops are there to defend it against Russia maybe taking offense to the idea that U.S. is building a naval base there. And we had William Gavelson say that it's an attempt to reverse the outcome of the Cold War. Well, Russia's not trying to reverse the outcome of the Cold War.
It's trying to stop a new one.
It's not happy about the outcome of the West-backed putsch that overthrew the Ukrainian government. And he said, we're seeing Russian aggression, not just on the front line, but being more increasingly aggressive posture in the Black Sea. They want to open new fronts. Wait a minute. You're building naval bases in the Black Sea, they're opening new fronts? No, you are opening new fronts and trying to restart the Cold War.
Yes. Well, I mean, Gavin Williamson may have forgotten that the last time the Royal Navy was active in the Black Sea was during the Crimean War in 1855. And also, I mean, history is teaching us some lessons. I mean, how did the U.S. War in the Gulf start in 1981? By constantly mentioning Saddam Hussein and his people raping women. I remember I studied in the U.S. at the time. And now we have the same methods used in U.S. domestic politics. I mean, this story with Kavanaugh, it's chicken coming back home to roost.
No, we've said it repeatedly on this program, and I'm absolutely convinced of it. The playbook and this iteration of it with the destruction, intentional destruction of Yugoslavia, and we have all these other conflicts, that playbook has been perfected, and John Brennan and Jim Comey brought it to America.
Exactly. Okay? Exactly.
And now they're having a forced regime change there. 1 minute, Mark.
Yeah, Idlib memorandums, way back at the beginning of last week, was signed by Russia and Turkey. I think it's a really bad move. It gives Turkey more time to
do what they should. Was it the only thing they could do? Counterintuitively.
It's creating a frozen conflict. They're bowing down to U.S. A saber rattling that they won't allow any attack on Idlib, and Turkey moving large amounts of military and arms to the Idlib front lines to protect their proxy jihadis. This creates a frozen conflict. Turkey is not going to take actions against al-Qaeda. They're cooperating with al-Qaeda and all the other jihadis there. The best outcome is al-Qaeda and all the other jihadis put on proxy Turkish uniforms, and Turkey continues to govern Idlib, and you can't have a political settlement in Syria with a new northern Cyprus governed by Turkey with proxies on the ground that believe that Sharia law should be instituted multi-confessional Arab republic.
Was it 2 years ago now, 3 years ago, the Brookings Institution was talking, they had their big plan on partition? Well, it looks like Turkey...
This is just giving Turkey more time, and they're actively putting more Turkish troops and fortifying themselves on Syrian territory. I don't know what Putin is thinking.
I guess it's not politically correct to say these days, but the fat lady hasn't sung yet when it comes to Syria. That's all the time we have for our extended version of our program. I hope you enjoyed it. We'll see you next week, and remember, crosstalk rules.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.
Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two big stories. First, Iran suffered a massive attack over the weekend that killed 29 people, including the four attackers, and wounded 70. We talk about who might be at fault and how it will affect regional dynamics, as well as the terrorist organization MEK, or the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, getting so much Western support from the likes of John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani. And then it's Monday. That means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including five that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein was summoned to the White House this morning as rumors swirled that he had either resigned or would be fired. Neither happened, but in Rosenstein's meeting with White House Chief of Staff John Kelly, he requested a meeting with the president on Thursday. The speculation now is that he will resign then. Next, federal prosecutors in New York are weighing criminal charges against former Obama White House General Counsel Greg Craig amid allegations that he failed to register as a foreign agent in a probe that is linked to the Paul Manafort investigation. Prosecutors are also considering charges against Craig's former law firm, international legal powerhouse Skadden Arps. Then Moscow will bolster Syria's air defense following the downing of a Russian plane last week by sending a modern S-300 air defense system to the Syrian army in the next 2 weeks. That's according to the Russian defense minister. The decision was made by Russian President Vladimir Putin personally because of Israeli involvement in the plane's shootdown. And then, as Senate Republicans push for a quick vote this week on Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, Senate Democrats are investigating a new allegation of sexual misconduct against him. Deborah Ramirez, who went to Yale with Kavanaugh, said that he exposed himself to her at a party. This is the second sexual harassment allegation against Brett Kavanaugh. And finally, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And in other headlines, the United Nations General Assembly is meeting this week in New York with the primary business of the meeting beginning tomorrow. There are talks expected between President Trump and Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau on NAFTA and trade between the two countries, and also between Trump and South Korean President Moon Jae-in about peace on the Korean Peninsula. The president also wanted to discuss Iran, but reports are that National Security Advisor John Bolton recommended against that because it would give Iranian President Rouhani a seat at the table. One proposal that the European Union is considering this week is approving a policy of sanctions against individuals who have been blamed for the use of chemical weapons. France and the UK have cited the use of chemical weapons in Salisbury and the poisoning of the Skripals, which has been blamed on Russia despite a lack of evidence, as well as chemical weapons use in Syria. The Organization for the Prohibition of Chemical Weapons has said that there were no chemical weapons used in Douma, the most recent site of accusations against the Syrian government. The Dallas police officer who fatally shot a man in his own apartment, thinking that it was hers, has been fired from her job based on adverse conduct when she was arrested for manslaughter and for the alleged shooting. The family and many residents in the area have been protesting the shooting of a black man by a white cop for many weeks. As many as 8,000 South Carolinians are on evacuation watch as floodwaters rise more than a week after Hurricane Florence hit the coast. Several local rivers are expected to contribute to up to 10-foot-high floodwaters that could break records. Hurricane Florence and the related flooding have already killed 44 people in North Carolina, South Carolina, and Virginia. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to Iran. Iranian officials this morning vowed unforgiving revenge over an attack on a military parade on Saturday that killed 29 people, including the four attackers, and wounded 70. The Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps blamed regional supporters of terrorism, meaning Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, both of which denied involvement, U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations Nikki Haley, meanwhile, said that Iran's president should look in the mirror before blaming others. And this was as Rudy Giuliani addressed the Iran Uprising Summit in Manhattan, hosted by the bizarre political cult and terrorist organization, the MEK, Mujahideen-e Khalq, a group that counts National Security Advisor John Bolton as one of its allies. You got that? We're joined from London by Masood Shajara. He's the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. And we're joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you both. Mohammed, let's start with you. You're in Tehran. This was a very unusual incident in that we normally don't see attacks like this in Iran. There was an attack claimed by ISIS a year ago, after which Iran responded by launching missiles into ISIS-held territory in Syria to make a point about the advanced state of its military technology, I suspect. But do we know definitively who did this? I know that the Iranian government called in the Dutch ambassador to complain because the group that claimed responsibility is actually registered in the Netherlands, of all places. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yes, well, I think there are two or three things that we need to keep in mind. One is that last year, the Saudi crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman, said we need to take the war against Iran inside Iran. Mm. And after that, ISIS attacked Tehran. And we know that ISIS and the Saudis from long ago had a very strong relationship. And, you know, to what extent it exists today, it would be a very complicated answer. But that's one issue. The second issue that is of importance is that immediately after the attack, the spokesperson of the organization that you were referring to, which is based in Europe and they have offices in the UK as well, he went on an Iranian language TV channel funded by Saudi Arabia called Iran International and accepted responsibility for the attack. And he was also welcomed on the show. This was shown in Iran repeatedly on TV, and it caused enormous outrage in Iran. So they accepted responsibility. The third point is that an advisor to the UAE Crown Prince also tweeted that this was not a terrorist attack, that a decision has been made to carry out these attacks inside Iran.
Oh, my.
And they will, in scope, in future. So the evidence has been provided by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. But what happened yesterday or last night was interesting. After the Iranians became increasingly angry, suddenly we saw a clip on the ISIS news agency, where they accepted responsibility. But the interesting thing about the clip was that it had incorrect information in it about the attack, and the attackers didn't say anything about being a part of ISIS. So the belief is that the people who had the clip sent it to ISIS, and that there is some sort of cooperation going on between ISIS and the Al-Ahwaziyya group that carried out the attack.
Let's talk about this Al-Ahwaz group. Masood Shajara, this was just such an odd thing to me. It says one of the groups that claimed the attack, and this is from the Netherlands Times, the Arab struggle movement for the liberation of Al-Ahwaz can be found on the Dutch Chamber of Commerce and is based in Delft in the Netherlands. And then it goes on to say that 25 people were killed, 70 were injured, two different groups claimed the attack, ISIS, and this Arab struggle movement for the liberation of Al-Ahwaz. What do they mean by Al-Ahwaz? Are they talking about the area in southwestern Iran where there are ethnic Arabs? What should we make of this group?
Well, this group has been operating and really is inspired by the sort of Gulf states. And in past, Saddam Hussein was involved in supporting this sort of Arab nationalism for sort of liberation of the Arab areas. And the reality is that these are just some individuals with the deep pockets financed by the Saudis and the Emiratis. And they go around the international community. I mean, I have seen them sort of appearing at the UN Human Rights Council as an NGO. And the reality is that they are involved in acts of terrorism. They have admitted this. There is also sort of clips available that this group and their leaders were in a conference in Egypt, in Cairo, which was supported by the Saudi Arabia. And in that clip, they are being questioned about their activities and so forth. And they're very upfront that they are involved in also military activities. And they also say very clearly that they are having a trip to go down to the United States and to get support from Trump administration. So really what is very clear is that the rhetorics that have been articulated by Trump administration, by the Saudis, by Emiratis, is now being put into action. And the international community has really failed to identify this as what it is, indeed, act of terrorism. When you look at the sort of media as a whole, be it BBC, CNN, and others, Reuters, and so forth, they have really shied away from articulating that this was act of terrorism. And, you know, I think this sort of behavior by international community and the media is indeed support for this type of action, and indeed for the continuation of this sort of action against innocent people in Iran. I mean, you know, many civilian perished, and even this wasn't in a war front. This was actually a march, and any sort of attack on any in that sort of environment is understood by international community as act of terrorism. It's almost as bizarre of saying that Rigby, which was knifed down in the streets of London because of the fact that he was a soldier, then therefore it's not act of terrorism. This is outrageous. This is not the standard that the international community looks at these things. But it seems that these standards cannot be extended to Iran and Iranian people.
I have to agree. You know, when I first heard the news of this attack, I just assumed that it would be major news throughout the weekend, that the focus would be on terrorism. The focus would be on the two groups, ISIS and this Dutch group. And it wasn't. I watched CNN. I watched MSNBC. I watched Fox even, looking for some mention of this attack, and I just didn't see any. Now, if you go onto the internet and you look for it, you can find Associated Press and Al Jazeera, but this just simply was not covered by the American media, and that surprises me, especially in light of the tweets that Mohammed mentioned coming from Saudi Arabia and from the United Arab Emirates. It seems, at the very least, as though there is circumstantial evidence that this was not just a group randomly attacking Iranian citizens, that this was a pre-planned, pre-approved operation. Mohammed, let's go back to you. I want to talk a little about the Mujahideen, the MEK. It's a fascinating group to me. It's headed by a woman named Miriam Rajavi. She has spent many, many years in first in Iraq and then in Europe. She comes to the United States every once in a while, and she's become very close to Rudy Giuliani, President Trump's primary attorney, and to John Bolton, the U.S. National Security Advisor. The reason that's odd, though, is because the MEK was for many, many years on the State Department's list of terrorist groups. And indeed, the MEK, during the period of the Shah, murdered not just American citizens, but they murdered the U.S. ambassador in Iran. They murdered the senior U.S. Military attaché in Iran. They attempted to kill an American general in Iraq. I mean, this is a group that has never been afraid to take up arms, to carry out bomb attacks, to carry out close-in assassinations. Somehow, and I think this is just simply through money and lobbying here in Washington, they were able to get themselves removed from the State Department's terrorism list. They have very powerful and important friends in the Republican Party now. And Miriam Rajavi, despite the fact that she runs and manages the MEK as a cult, as a personality cult, rather than as an armed group, has found sympathizers, not just in Washington, but in the White House. What can you tell us about the MEK and how it's transitioned from this orphan terrorist group into a U.S. ally?
Well, first of all, it's even there are other interesting aspects to it as well. The real leader of the MEK was her husband.
Yes.
She wasn't actually married to him. She was married to someone else. And then her husband wanted her, and Rajavi, the head of the organization, wanted her, and her husband gave her up to the leader of the MEK. So then she became the wife of the head of the MEK.
I did not know that.
And then now we don't know, or at least most people, I guess, well, I don't know, what happened to her husband, the former or the current head of the MEK. He's missing.
Yes, he's been missing for many years, apparently. No one will say what happened to him.
And she and her organization, they were fighting for Saddam Hussein during the Iran-Iraq War. So imagine, for example, British civilians during the Second World War fighting for the Nazis. That's the sort of status that she and her organization have among Iranians. They fought for years as Saddam Hussein's foot soldiers and intelligence officers until the very end of the war. And the United States, even back then, the United States and European countries considered it a terrorist organization, but under different names, they allowed them to begin opening offices during Saddam's reign and during the Iran-Iraq War. They allowed them to open offices throughout Europe and the United States. And then more recently, of course, they've become openly recognized as a so-called legitimate organization, despite the fact that it's a cult, despite the fact that women and men are separated. They're not allowed to marry. They're not allowed to have relationships with each other. Their children are taken away from them, and so on. And these people carried out huge attacks, bomb attacks in Tehran when I was a teenager. Once the windows in our house all exploded, all broke because of an explosion that happened, I think, less than a kilometer away, where 11 people were killed, including, I think, an Armenian family of four, roughly 7-something in the morning. I was getting ready to go to school. So we Iranians have, you know, very sharp memories and very dark memories about this organization. But now we see that they are the darling. I mean, under Obama and under Clinton and under Bush, they were supported by the United States, and under Reagan as well. But now the United States government openly embraces them as if they are heroes. And of course, not the international community, but the Western media and Western think tanks take them very seriously, and many of them consider them or call them freedom fighters.
Masoud Shajara, I have to say that this reminds me very much of the 1980s and the Reagan administration, perhaps in reverse, where Afghan Mujahideen were invited to the White House. They were given VIP red carpet treatment. And then once the Soviets were driven out of Afghanistan, they kept their arms. And the next thing we know, we have September 11th and we're fighting against them. But this MEK situation is in reverse. What's the European attitude? You're in London. What's the European attitude to Miriam Rajavi and the MEK?
Well, unfortunately, very much the same. I mean, they were recognized as a terrorist organization. But even then, at that time, I remember very clearly on 7/7, when we had underground bombing and by Al-Qaeda supporters. On that very same day, even though that they were recognized as a fully as a terrorist organization, they were allowed to have a function in House of Lords in support to sort of get them out of the list of the terrorist organization. And the people who were standing up in supporting them, they were members of House of Lords and very influential politician, which indeed all of them collectively were also part of the support group of supporting sort of State of Israel. It was actually, you could see that the infrastructure, and I'm sure that is also the same in United States and elsewhere, the infrastructure which was coming to help to unsubscribe this group out of the terrorist organization were indeed those who were lobbying for the state of Israel, and it's continuing to be the same. And the fact of the matter is that, you know, this group is indeed not only killed Iranians, but they actually committed war crimes against the Kurdish community and the Shias in the south as basically foot soldiers for Saddam Hussein. And they've shown in their whole history that they're willing to be sort of sold to highest bidder. And the fact of the matter is that what we are seeing, the sort of support and sort of identifying this sort of terrorist organization, which there are many reports on them by Human Rights Watch, by Amnesty, by ourselves and many other groups, identifying them as one of the most brutal groups who's committing acts of terror and indeed committing acts of inhumanity against their own members as a cult. And this group is now becoming the sort of the darling of U.S. administration. And indeed, even in Europe and in France and so forth, as the hopeful for bringing democracy into Iran. This is how absurd it is. And this is why this is also very important in the context of what happened in Ahvaz. United States and the West are now supporting. They're so desperate. They're supporting the most unsavory groups and encouraging them. And they are indeed fundamentally terrorist, and they're supporting them, and they think that they could actually sell this to the Iranian nation as a means of a real sort of hope for freedom and justice. And this is absurd. No Iranian will accept this. And indeed, I think most observers really see through this bizarre facade that is being played out.
Masoud, I have to say too that the United States made this exact same mistake 15 years ago when the Defense Department here in the U.S. convinced itself that Ahmad Chalabi should be the president of Iraq. Well, Ahmad Chalabi hadn't been to Iraq in 35 years, and the few Iraqis who had ever heard of him knew that he was a crook and a thief, but that didn't stop the Pentagon and the Office of the Vice President from trying to install him as president of Iraq. It's as though we're seeing the same thing playing out all over again. Mohammed, the Iranian government warned Israel in the aftermath of this attack. They did it in the press, of course, because there are no diplomatic relations between Iran and Israel. We also know that over the past 5 or 6 years, the Israelis have cooperated increasingly closely with the governments of Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Do you think this attack may have had something to do with Israel as well?
Well, the Iranian intelligence services are still trying to find out exactly what happened, what people were involved. They're very confident about who ultimately is behind it, but they haven't made any formal statements yet. And I think that the important thing that we have to keep in mind is that Israel, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates and the United States, they're all working together on this broader project. So any attack on Iran, I think the Iranians feel is something that if the Saudis and the Emiratis are involved, the Americans to some degree and the Israeli regime to some degree must be involved as well, especially since the Israelis have been supporting ISIS and Al-Qaeda alongside its border with Syria. They too have a tradition of supporting these groups, and they are also closely linked to the MEK. The MEKs very close to the Israeli regime, and they have a history with them. The fake laptop that was produced by the MEK or given to by the MEK, which contained allegations regarding Iran's nuclear program, of laptop which later was proven to be full of falsely constructed information. This was given to the MEK by the Israeli government, the Israeli intelligence. So the relationship between these different extremist organizations and terrorist organizations and Israelis is something that is established. But I would like to point out one very important point, that for the Iranians, the MEK is like the people who carried out 9/11. There is huge contempt for them. Although the strange thing is that the people who carried out 9/11, Al-Qaeda, they are now being supported by U.S. allies and the U.S. indirectly in Syria. But that's another story altogether. But for Iran, the MEK is hated probably more than even Saddam Hussein himself because of the treacherous nature of this cult group.
So, Masoud, where does the United States, where do the Western European countries go from here? There's been a devolution in Western relations with Iran, especially between Iran and the United States. Now there's this terrorist attack, appointing it to close U.S. allies. What happens now? Is there any way to turn this around and to actually improve relations between Iran and the Western nations?
Well, it's very difficult to see how could that happen in the current sort of environment. I mean, the reality is that we have been hearing from Trump for a very long time this sort of rhetorics of supporting sort of groups and the wooing that there will be sort of action against Iran and so forth. And when this manifests itself in this sort of very clearly a terrorist action against ordinary people, killing children as young as 4, then even then we are not seeing any change. I mean, the reality is that at times like this, usually the international community and politicians, even if they don't want to, they come together and at least they offer condolences and they try to sort of have some sort of sympathy with the ordinary people in those nations. And we have seen whenever there's been acts of terrorism in Paris or New York or anywhere else, indeed politicians have put their politics into one side and come out and given some sort of a sympathy for the nation, at least. In the absence of that, and the fact is not only silence, and what we are seeing, that Trump in particular is actually looking at this and pointing to the fact that people are unhappy in Iran. This is nothing to do with issues of disagreements in Iran, be it on the economy or the way that people are suffering under huge economical pressures. This is purely, clearly act of naked sort of terrorism. And it should be recognized. In failing to do that, I think it gives a very, very clear signal, not just to politicians, but to ordinary people in Iran, that, look, we are going to support all sorts of atrocity against you. We are going to plan economical war against you, sanctions which is going to hurt you in the way that it has never hurt you before. And therefore, you know, saying this and with their actions and with their sort of policy and with their speeches, it really is contradiction to the fact that, you know, we have got the best wish of the people in our heart. And the reality is people in Iran, and indeed the rest of Middle East, are recognizing that U.S. policy will bring no benefit to them. And they are becoming more distant from U.S. policy. And I think that's why the U.S. is so much hated element in the Middle East. And unfortunately, I think Europeans are not that far behind.
I think you're probably right. Well, we'll leave it there. We were joined from London by Masoud Shajara. Masoud is the founder of the Islamic Human Rights Commission. And we were joined from Tehran by Mohammed Mirandi. He's an expert on American studies and post-colonial literature who teaches at the University of Tehran. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou. It's Monday, and that means it's our weekly half-hour segment, Technology Rules with Chris Garafa, a weekly guide on how monopoly corporations and the national surveillance state are threatening cherished freedoms, civil rights, and civil liberties. We're joined from New Haven, Connecticut, by web developer and technologist Chris Garafa. Chris, good to have you back.
Hey, good to be back, John. Brian, we miss you.
Yes, we do. We miss Brian. Chris, one of the important things that you and I have been talking about is the role of these enormous corporations like Facebook and Google, and their business practices as they relate to voting or as they relate to upcoming elections. We had a guest last week, Dr. Robert Epstein, who is an expert in this kind of thing. And he talked a lot about how Google's algorithms can affect voting patterns and actually may have affected as many as 12 million votes in the 2016 election. So tell us a little bit about Facebook and Google and how the White House is drafting an order looking at them.
Yes, this comes from a Bloomberg Quint, which is one of the Bloomberg services. And it says the White House is considering a draft order to look into Google and Facebook, which, you know, on the surface might not sound all that bad. There's a whole lot to look into here, right? But what it is, it's actually going to be talking about their supposed censorship of conservative voices in online media. So there's a number of issues here, right? The conservative voices that they're talking about are few and far between in terms of who's being censored. We've seen, you know, certainly Alex Jones was a major example that was made recently, but it's primarily left-wing, progressive, and foreign news sources that are censored by Facebook and Twitter and Google. I mean, we already know Sputnik is, you know, ranked lower in Google search results. Now, Google denies that, you know, in some ways actually denies that that's the case, but in other ways has said that they are explicitly doing that because of supposed, you know, Russian interference in the elections that still has yet to be proven. The same is true with RT. Facebook has gone and directly just taken down the pages of Venezuela Analysis and other progressive or, you know, international news sources that are going against the mainstream U.S. media and U.S. government narrative. So this idea that the White House is going to look into social media companies because of what they're saying, actually Trump says, quote, social media is totally discriminating against Republican/conservative voices. This is somebody who, you know, has many, many millions of Twitter followers, right? And often likes or even retweets, you know, some of the worst conservative voices or right-wing voices on that service. You know, in many ways, in some ways, he won his election based on Twitter, and his supporters, you know, are rabid fans on Twitter and putting his stories and other conservative stories out there. There's a lot to look at here.
You know, one of the things that surprised me in this article was that this meeting at the White House where they were discussing this issue also included a representative from the Justice Department's antitrust division. And the reason that this antitrust attorney attended the meeting is that Attorney General Sessions is actually considering criminal charges against Facebook and Google's parent company.
Yeah, that's right. And that could be a very interesting case, depending on how it actually goes. I believe that there are actually antitrust issues with both Google and Facebook and a number of the other, you know, social media and search companies. But I can't imagine that the Trump administration, the Trump Justice Department, and the Federal Telecommunications, the FTC, are actually going to do anything that's going to help. It's going to be more about a show about the, you know, the supposed conservative censorship.
One of the interesting things, too, is that, well, Facebook is really worried about this, as they well should be. And so what they've done is they hired Senator John Kyle. Now, Kyle had been a senator, Republican senator from Arizona, highly respected. He was in the Senate a long time, and he retired, and he went to work as a lobbyist. And they hired Kyle to look at their algorithm to see if it was biased. In the middle of this probe, Kyle was reappointed to the Senate to finish out the term of John McCain. The probe is ongoing, but Kyle has stepped away from it. And the reason why they did this is that they're really afraid that Sessions is serious. And even though antitrust normally doesn't pertain specifically to issues of bias, of political bias, it could in this case, and they're worried about it. Another thing, too, is that a couple of libertarian-leaning Republican groups have written to Jeff Sessions asking him to drop this, saying that they have a fear that, quote, the inquiry will be to accomplish through intimidation with the First Amendment bars, interference with editorial judgment. Now, as you pointed out rightly, it's organizations on the left that are really the subject of bias on Facebook and Google. The groups that you pointed out certainly leap to mind. And even Think Progress was censored last week on Facebook. And in its place, Facebook was recommending an article in the right-wing National Review.
That's right. You know, and there's another aspect to this that doesn't get talked about very often, but it's the censorship of individuals on Facebook. And particularly, you see this with LGBTQ people, people of color, in particular women of color, and this is almost never spoken about. People often will throw out little things, you know, men are trash, right? You know, straight people suck, you know, whatever it is, right? You know, and it's not saying, you know, they hate all men, right? But so I have a friend who actually posted, you know, posted about this, and she started it out with men are trash. Now that I've got your attention, and she went through this, she explained this entire situation where she has a stalker who has created over a dozen Facebook accounts to harass her, and Facebook has done absolutely nothing about
boy.
It. But then she posted this thing that started with men are trash. Now that I've got your attention, she was actually blocked from posting on Facebook for a few days for that. Meanwhile, this guy has created a few new accounts to continue to harass her. And Facebook has done nothing about it. And you see this on Twitter as well. Very famous voices in oppressed communities will get their accounts shut down or, you know, limited so they can't post and they can't like things or, you know, talk to people or have conversations for days at a time because somebody was, you know, supposedly offended by something they posted about their own situation or their own liberation. And this has to be part of the conversation because Facebook and Twitter and social media networks are some of the ways that people, you know, make their relationships and organize and take care of each other when they, you know, aren't able to do that in, you know, in real life and real life spaces.
Mm-hmm. You know, a couple of our regular guests on this show were suspended from Twitter for reasons that really are a mystery. There's one in particular, a close friend of mine, Peter Van Buren, who's a State Department whistleblower. He was having an argument with a journalist, a New York Times journalist on Twitter. It was a perfectly fine intellectual argument. And he was not just suspended from Twitter, but he was banned for life. And he maintains it's because he was critical of Israel and the New York Times is reporting on Israel.
I wouldn't doubt it. I'm not familiar with that case and I'm going to look into it, but I certainly wouldn't doubt it that that's what happened, is that somebody with such a high profile would get banned for bringing attention to that.
Yeah, this is something that I think bears further watching, and it's something that has the potential to be very dangerous, I think. Chris, there are a couple of other issues that are bubbling up here in Washington that are, in my view, of equal import. What else is happening?
So on Wednesday, there's going to be a hearing. The U.S. Senate Committee on Commerce, Science, and Transportation is actually having a hearing. They're calling it Examining Safeguards for Consumer Data Privacy. So, right, that sounds good at the, you know, by the name. But here's the problem. Here's the witness list. AT&T, Amazon, Google, Twitter, Apple, and Charter Communications. That seems very one-sided to me, doesn't it, John? What we're looking at here is corporate leaders who have been some of the worst offenders when it comes to consumer data privacy are the only ones that are going to be testifying at this hearing. Congress, you know, often brings in expert witnesses from, you know, third-party groups to testify at these. There are no consumer advocates on this witness list.
Let me interrupt you on that, because I want to tell our listeners just how morally bankrupt this is. I spent 2.5 years on Capitol Hill working on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And when you schedule a hearing, here's how it is. Whatever party has the majority is in charge of scheduling the hearings. Now, in the interest of bipartisanship, the majority party gets to choose two witnesses and the minority party gets to choose one. Or what you do is the majority chooses two, the minority chooses one, and then the majority and minority together choose a fourth. So it's not like the Democrats didn't have a say in these guests. The Democrats had a say, and they agreed with the Republicans to keep consumer privacy experts out of this hearing.
That's absolutely right. So this is a Republican-led committee right now. You know, it's got the chairman is John Thune from South Dakota. Mm-hmm. Some of the other, you know, key members here, we're looking at Ted Cruz. You know, we're looking at a number of other prominent Republicans, including Roy Blunt. But there are many Democrats on this. Tom Udall, Ed Markey, Senator Richard Blumenthal from Connecticut, you know, my home state here, who have not put any privacy advocates, you know, if Senator Blumenthal hears it, I would have been happy to travel down or recommend some folks. And it's disappointing, but not surprising that there are no privacy advocates. There are so many organizations they could have gotten, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, Center for Media Rights, and so many others to testify at this, and they're not there. So I'm going to be watching this hearing. I'm assuming it's going to be live streamed. I will be watching it, and you know, we'll keep an eye on it. And maybe we talk about it next week, John, and see exactly, you know, what these legal directors, they're very, you know, these are very legal positions, chief privacy officers, general counsel, vice president for public policy. These are not technical people who are going to be at this hearing.
Chris, tell us what would be discussed in a hearing like this. There's so much that could fall under of the rubric of transparency. What exactly are they going to be talking about?
Well, I think what they're going to be saying is that Amazon and Google and AT&T and so forth care about our privacy and are doing everything they can to, you know, stave off these evil Russian and Chinese hackers, right? There's going to be nothing of substance, I think, that comes out of this. I think it's going to be just like we saw with Dorsey and Sandberg and others at, you know, in front of other Senate committees. I think it's going to be a lot of platitudes about caring about privacy, and it's going to turn into a Russiagate and anti-China love fest, essentially, between the witnesses and this panel. What we should have experts testifying about what these companies are doing and calling for further investigations and well-funded investigations into the privacy practices of these companies, why they're sharing data with companies that we've never even heard of and being completely, you know, opaque about their privacy practices.
We are speaking from New Haven, Connecticut with web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris, you sent us an email here that included an article that was chilling. At first, you know, it may not sound like a big deal, but it's a very big deal. And this is that John Hancock, the insurance company, will include fitness tracking in all life insurance policies. So they are going to follow you electronically to see if you are exercising and sell you life insurance based on how healthy you are.
That's right. And, you know, many of us have been wondering when this was going to happen.
There's been talk about this for a long time. Yes,
there certainly has. You know, you have devices like the Fitbit and the Apple Watch. And it's very interesting that John Hancock announced this right after Apple announced the new Apple Watch last week. And, you know, I do need to say this is a really fantastic product for people that have health concerns, right? The Apple Watch, it'll actually track and does a form of EKG on you just from your wrist and can warn you, right, about health issues. And that's the kind of technology that we need. It's certainly not accessible, you know, for most people at the price point it's at. But then we have corporate capitalism that comes in and says, okay, well, now we're going to require everybody who gets an insurance policy from us, life insurance policy, to have one of these devices, and they're going to track your health and your movement and all of that through the device you have. And that's just such an invasion of privacy. And the fact that we need to have life insurance in the first place is kind of a scary thought. But then to require this sort of day-to-day tracking is really just a major invasion of privacy.
So what exactly is going to go back to the company? What kind of data besides your heart rate, et cetera?
So they're saying that there's not a lot of information they're saying about exactly what's going to go back to the company. But let's talk about what these devices track. They track the number of steps you take. They track your heart rate throughout the day. If you wear them at night, they can track how well you sleep, when you go into REM sleep, and you know, other details about your sleep. If you choose to, you can actually log your food consumption in the
phone.
Yeah, and your phone, and it's synced up to the service. And so from there, you know, people do that to count their calories. It's a very useful thing. But now they're going to get these major discounts and then require, and it's going to be required to log your workout, and it's going to track the steps that you're taking, you know, and that then leads to where you are. If it can track how many steps you're taking, it has GPS and tracks where you are as well.
Son of a gun. It says here in this article, which is in VentureBeat, venturebeat.com, it says, in theory, everybody wins as policyholders are incentivized to adopt healthy habits and insurance companies collect more premiums and pay less in claims if customers live longer. Okay, that sounds great. Privacy and consumer advocates, however, have raised questions about whether insurers may eventually use the data to select the most profitable customers while hiking rates for those who do not participate. The insurance industry has said that it is heavily regulated and must justify in actuarial terms its reasons for any rate increases or policy changes. I mean, you can't deny that that's exactly what's going to happen. If you are unhealthy or if you refuse to wear this Apple Watch or whatever device they happen to give you, you're going to pay more for your life insurance than someone would pay if they were participating in the program.
That's right. And, you know, this goes even deeper than that. In the last couple of weeks, I saw a headline. A study says that women who ride horses or have horses tend to live longer. So some people assume that that means that horses make women live longer. But that's not the case. If you've got the money to have a horse, you probably have the money to have access to better food, regular doctor visits, and so on and so forth. So if you have the people that are going to suffer are the people who can't even afford one of these devices, can't even afford to have health insurance, let alone life insurance. So we need to really be paying attention to why these insurance policies are going to be so out of the reach of average, you know, working and poor people that, you know, they aren't even going to be accessible.
Right. Chris, keeping with Apple here, something that I think is a little disturbing, Apple iTunes, the iTunes store issued new terms and conditions last week on Monday, a week ago today. And this is with the release of iOS 12. I just downloaded it on Friday, the Watch OS 5, TV OS 12, etc. And it says that Apple now will take into account certain information about how you use your iOS device or Apple TV to determine a rating for that device. Those sentences mean nothing to me, but this is actually pretty important, isn't it?
It's really important. So the basis for this is, you know, if you've, and the phones come with this feature turned on, right? When you're typing, it recommends the next word that you're going to type, which, you know, for me, I think it's super helpful, right? That it analyzes your typing patterns and says, you know, I'm on my way, and it types home or, you know, to the office. That's really helpful. But the analysis that they use here is now going to be used to see if they can trust your devices. And so they've always done this sort of, you know, data collection and all of that on your account. But now we need to know more about what trusting your devices mean. Apple talks about this being about fraudulent purchases and reviews or, you know, having your account or your device stolen, right? But what else is Apple going to do with this information? They say they're going to be fuzzing the data, meaning that not, you know, it won't store the exact information, but an approximation of it. But we have no idea what the algorithm is behind that. And it's been shown in the past that even when you approximate data, it can be possible to identify it and kind of unfuzz it and bring it back to identify the person whose data that is. And then potentially in this case, what they're actually typing. Having said that, I would recommend that people do update, despite this, to iOS 12, mm-hmm. Which did come out last week. There are a number of performance improvements, but also just security fixes that are in the update that I think are very important for people to have, especially if they're doing anything of importance that requires security on their phones. But I'm looking forward to doing some more research on this particular policy and seeing what we can come up with in terms of how Apple is storing this, how long they're storing it on their servers. They just say stored for a fixed time, but they do not define what that fixed time is. So we need to get a lot more information out of Apple. I would hope maybe that this would come up on the hearings Wednesday, but I doubt it's going to happen.
I want to get back to Facebook now. There's something that was shocking to me that you forwarded to us. I want to read the opening paragraph of this article in Ars Technica. It says here, hundreds of thousands of Americans drive for Uber. And the company is looking for many more. It runs ads on Facebook that say, for example, driving towards something, make extra money when it works for you and get there faster. Another touts, earn $1,100 in Nashville for your first 200 trips. Limited time guarantee, terms apply. There's just one catch. These ads are not visible to women. These are ads that are targeted only at men, and it's 15 different major companies across the United States that have taken out ads on Facebook, and those ads are invisible to women. Now, this is patently illegal. The Supreme Court ruled in 1973 that it is illegal for an employer to take out job ads in newspapers with parameters like that, such as, help wanted, men only. And there's a guy here, Galen Sherwin from the ACLU. He's an attorney with the ACLU. He says these ads are illegal. It's been established for 5 decades. So, Chris Garofa, my question is, how in the world is Facebook getting away with something like this? It's not like they don't have any attorneys on staff.
Well, let's look at what a Facebook spokesman said. This is Joe Osborne. First, he starts by saying there's no place for discrimination on Facebook. But then he goes on to say, we look forward to defending our practices once we have an opportunity to review the complaint. They don't look forward to addressing these practices or shutting down the whatever limitations or setups allowed these companies to do this. They look forward to defending their practices. They claim that this is not discrimination to be able to target employment ads by age, by sex, and by other protected classes. But they have not explained how that's going to get around the 1973 Supreme Court ruling. Again, this is a major, major issue. Now, there gets into other situations here, right? Where is it Facebook's responsibility or is it the private company's responsibility? There's some legislation that prevents a site like Facebook or Twitter from being responsible for what its users post. And if that legislation were changed, it actually would have some chilling effects for other smaller news sites and entertainment sites. But Facebook shouldn't be providing the tools to target ads by race, sex, gender, or any other protected class. That's something I've set up Facebook ads and it's right there. You can filter by all of these things in addition to things that are useful like location, but especially for employment and for housing. These things should not be something that Facebook allows.
Yeah, I was surprised. And this is all the result of an investigation by ProPublica, which is, in my view, one of the best investigative news sites in the world. They're really quite good. They found that there were these 15 employers just over the past year who have advertised jobs on Facebook exclusively to one sex. It says here, many of the ads seem to target in accordance with stereotypes. For example, the Pennsylvania State Police boosted a post targeted to men with text saying, Pennsylvania State Troopers earn a starting salary of $59,567. Apply now. But that went only to men. A Michigan-based trucking company took out ads targeting not just men, but men interested in college football. And there was a community health center in Idaho that sought nurses, but only women got to see those ads. Again, it's illegal, but they seem to be getting away with it. And there is this gray area that you mentioned that it looks like is going to have to be litigated at some point.
Yeah, this is going to have to go through the courts. And I look forward to that case coming to the courts. I hope ProPublica releases a little more of their research. What they've done so far has been fantastic. And we really should keep an eye on this because not just with the discrimination part, but the part about who's responsible, as that goes through the courts, it's going to be extremely important because it'll have chilling effects across the internet, depending on which way that case goes.
Well, we're at about 5 minutes left, and there's another important story I want to get to before we talk about your tech tip of the week. And this is that the government can spy on journalists now. In the U.S., using what's called the invasive foreign intelligence process, this is a piece that came out of The Intercept. Could you explain that?
Sure. So there is a Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act requires approval from the Justice Department, and particularly some of the highest ranking officials in the Justice Department, right? And this is, we're talking specifically about applications for media entities or members of the media. Now, the high level of supervision, as The Intercept points out, is just a couple of the highest ranking, is actually the attorney general or deputy attorney general or their delegate. But these are political positions, right? The attorney general, I mean, we're seeing it even today. These are very political positions, and especially under the Trump administration, but really under any administration, they're going to use that position to approve or reject requests for spying on American journalists and foreign journalists based on the political climate. The FISA courts already have very little supervision. The Justice Department claims that this is a higher level of supervision, but they claim that because this is a higher level employee, a director that has to approve it. But that's not a higher level of supervision. There is no or very little transparency in this.
There's a comment in this article by a professor at Drexel University saying that A probable example of this would be surveillance of reporters who are working for somewhere like RT, the state-funded Russian television network, and sort of our sister network, really, is what it is. It says here, as a consequence, anyone who is talking to reporters for RT would also be put under surveillance. The reporters are probably conscious that they are subject to surveillance, but their sources might not be. That's frightening to me. I walk over from our radio studio to RT with some frequency. There are a lot of people that we have on this show who are regular contributors at RT. It's all on the up and up. It's all out in the open. My goodness, it's broadcast on the air. So it's not like it's a secret. And then when I'm done, I get in an Uber and I go home. But somehow this is a threat to democracy. At least that's what the government wants us to believe.
Right. And, you know, of course, they're talking about Russia in this, but these memos that were released are actually from 2015.
Right.
Right. So this is even
the Obama administration.
The Obama administration. And this certainly has been going on for much longer than that, as The Intercept points out. So this isn't even about Russia necessarily. This has been about any foreign or U.S. domestic news outlet that doesn't abide by the policies of the U.S. government in terms of its foreign or domestic policy, and parrot that official line or do something that's within its bounds of what's acceptable and what's not. It does mention the USSR as, you know, so that ties it to Russia in those comments. But this has been used, as we see in this article and in other places, in so many other instances, especially in South America as well.
Yeah. We've got a minute left. I'm sorry that we're cutting it so close, but give us your tech tip for the week.
So my tech tip this week is how to spot a tech support scam. You know, often you'll see stories about somebody who's gotten a call from Microsoft. Microsoft is never going to call you out of the blue. Neither is Apple, neither is Google. These companies aren't going to call you out of the blue and say, hey, you have a virus on your computer. Give me access. Go to this website. If you get those, just hang up on them. Don't listen to anything they say. They often prey on the elderly with these. Just ignore them and tell your family and friends, don't answer them. These companies aren't going to just call you and say, hey, we noticed a problem on your computer. What they're trying to do is actually get access to your computer so that they can get your passwords, your credit card, your banking information.
Happened to me just recently. I don't have a Microsoft computer. And I let the guy talk for a little while in his very thick Indian accent. And then I told him I won't say what I told him to do. So we'll leave it there. We were joined from New Haven, Connecticut by web developer and technologist Chris Garaffa. Chris joins us every Monday to talk about technology, and he'll be back next week. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.